Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, tennis fans from around the globe. The following program is a presentation of the Yellow Ball Network.
Are we on?
Yep, we're on.
All right, let's go.
Broadcasting live from the Tennis Dynamic Studio in downtown Marietta, Georgia, this is the We Coach Tennis Radio Show on the Yellow Ball Network. Your host for the show this week is J.P. Weber.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. We're on late tonight on a Sunday night. I've tried to do a little bit of adjustment here the last few weeks, actually the last couple months, trying to get some shows in with some people at some different times. That way we can get a different and varied audience and variety of people listening. We'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to call us in on the Yellow Ball Hotline. That number is 646-652-4856. And normally we're on every noon at noon every Tuesday, but we've made these adjustments. Like I said, you can download the episodes if you go to iTunes and you put it in, just like you can put in the Rolling Stones or We Coach Tennis, and they both come up. I mean, I love it. It's you can put in the Who. And We Coach Tennis comes up. So go to iTunes, put it in, it'll come up. You can get the episodes right there. You can download them. They don't cost anything. The Rolling Stones cost. The Who cost. We Coach Tennis doesn't cost anything. And so we're going to be on tonight. I'm going to have a 78-foot soapbox, and we'll be on in just a few seconds. We're going to take a quick commercial break. And when we come back, we're going to have on the show tonight, Dr. Ray Brown. Coaches and players, if you play on a tennis court in the Southeast, you've probably played on a tennis court designed, constructed, lighted, or resurfaced by courtmakers.com. Marshall Dye and the guys at Courtmakers will work on any type of court. From my experience with them, they work in a professional manner, they show up on time like they say they will, and they never leave a mess. Courtmakers can provide for all equipment needs. Call them at 770-795-795.
8400. 770-795-8400. That's courtmakers.com.
Hi, this is Coach Chuck Creasy. I take great pride in calling it the way it is. It's a meat and potato principle of coaching that no one really cares what you know unless they know that you care. As a parent also, I want this and very skilled hands working with my youngster. Coach J.P. Weber's 30 years of experience speaks for itself. Go see him at Laurel Park in Marietta, Georgia. His website is tennisdynamics.net. Tennisdynamics.net.
Hey, come play the Marietta Grand Prix. It's a lot of fun. You get to play a lot of tennis, and we have Chick-fil-A sandwiches from Chick-fil-A. And you get to eat a lot. And if you can, you can play doubles with your friends or with your dad or your mom.
Hey folks, this is J.P. Weber. Take it from the kid. The 2015 Handmade Charlotte Marietta Grand Prix Series of Tournaments is a great way to spend the day with the family playing tennis. To find out more, go to www.tennisdynamics.net. That's tennisdynamics.net, where you can call us at the Laurel Park Tennis Center at 770-919-8602.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. Don't know much about geography. Don't know much trigonometry. Don't know much about algebra. Don't know what a sliding rule is for. But I do know what it was too. And if this one could be with you, what a wonderful world this would be. Now I don't claim to be an A student, but I'm trying to be. For maybe by being an A student, baby, I can win your love for me. Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. La ta 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 ta.
Okay, we're here on the We Coach Tennis Radio Show, and I'm going to jump right up tonight. My special guest on the show is Dr. Ray Brown, but tonight before I get to Dr. Brown, let me go get on my 78-foot soapbox here a little bit. I've been itching to talk just a little bit about this. It won't much have anything to do with what Dr. Brown will be talking about, I don't think. Maybe he could probably find some correlation, but I went. My son was ball boying for the Georgia Tech match between UGA and Georgia Tech. Went down to watch the match this weekend. The singles and doubles, the match was over in 2 hours and 5 minutes. 2 hours and 5 minutes. Now, I had just watched a match with Ferrer at the Australian Open that was 3.5 hours plus, and they called it a battle. And it was singles only. So I'm hoping to understand as we go forward. I don't think we're going to be able to call college tennis matches that last 2.5 hours for singles and doubles. Two great institutions, Georgia Tech, good team, good players. Georgia, good team, good players going out, battling 2 hours, 5 minutes, singles and doubles. The doubles was over in 20 minutes. Now, they stopped the doubles when the first doubles match was finished and then the second doubles match finished and it clinched that point. Boom, they stopped. So UGA came back, though, and they won all four singles matches in, I guess, you know, about an hour and a half time with the five-minute break in between, and it was over. Now, you know, I suppose that, you know, they stayed on. We stayed on afterward because there was one match left that was superfluous, basically, to what they're trying to do. I mean, they stopped the doubles that was superfluous, but they, for some reason, didn't stop the singles, which was superfluous. The Tech guy won, which was good for Tech. But 2 hours and 5 minutes to play singles and doubles between two good teams, I mean, I don't know what to think. The whole match, you know, the way I look at it, you know, with that extra time now, the Athens, the guys from UGA would be able to jump in the van and be on Broad Street there at UGA before 10 o'clock, out drinking cocktails, celebrating. And, you know, I suppose there's a segment of society that's going to like all this shortened stuff. It's going to be more convenient, and that might be the case. But, you know, going home in a reasonable hour and getting your dinner and all that other stuff, it still doesn't seem to me, when you're there watching it, like a tennis match. Doubles, 20 minutes. And so I think the next piece of the puzzle is going to be the tour. If you watch, and everybody mark my words here, I've been saying this, that the next piece of the puzzle for this sort of the industry of tennis will be the tour, guys, the ATP Tour, and ultimately the Grand Slams. They're looking to shorten all that. 2 hours and 5 minutes, the convenient tennis match. And with that, I'm done with my 78-foot soapbox, and I want to bring on my special guest here, Dr. Ray Brown. Dr. Brown, I played a little bit I played a little bit of Sam Cooke and did my 78-foot soapbox. I don't know when you came in or there, but the Sam Cooke song was a little bit about, we're going to talk about science, and I don't know much about science or history of those things, like the song goes, but I'm hoping you're going to be able to illuminate us on that. Did you happen to hear anything about, before we go into a couple of the topics that we're going to discuss, did you hear anything about of my soapbox where I talked about the shortness of the matches?
I did hear that. Yes, I heard.
Any thoughts there from you on that? Or do you have any? You have any feelings on that?
Well, it sounds like the level of concentration of the average person has dropped. Is what it comes down to. They just can't concentrate very long. I don't think that's a good thing.
We're not testing them in that regard. We certainly have shied away from testing them in any of that area. I would imagine it's going to be. I think it's going to go across the board, and I think it changes tennis. I think it changes tennis drastically. So, Dr. Brown, do me first real quick a favor, and would you please give a little bit about your background? And where you're from and where you are now and what you're doing with your tennis coaching and everything?
Sure. Yeah, I started in the industry 30 some odd years ago, quite a long time ago, and I spent most of my time in the world of counterterrorism and intelligence, and got into neuroscience about 16 to 20 years ago in response to a neurological problem that happened to a friend of mine, and we developed with the idea of developing a new form of brain trauma rehabilitation, and we needed some venue in which to work that out, in which we could start studying how normal people think under complex situations. And that's a very novel idea in the world of neuroscience, because most of what we know is from brain trauma, cancer, disease of the brain, getting kicked in the head by a mule, that sort of thing, or from rabbits and rats and things like that. But normal human beings really has not been able to provide a source of information about how the human brain operates. So we decided, well, about 16, 20 years ago, let's see if we can make this happen. Maybe we can actually establish a program where we're able to gather information about normal humans performing complex but normal tasks. And the results of all of this, these many years of work, will be published as a chapter in a book this coming spring on brain dynamics. It's one of two chapters that I have written. And that's what it's based on, looking at the most current and advanced theory of how the human brain works, and then asking the question, is there some way we can test the validity of this theory with normal subjects? And we designed a tennis program precisely around those ideas that, that Freeman at Berkeley had put together, called the K3 theory. And so that's where we are. I got into coaching by accident because we were successful. And when you're successful, people want to send their kids to you. And as a result, we have a backlog of kids. We get more requests than we can possibly fulfill for kids to come into our program because the program is very unique. So anyway, we started off in the world of intelligence. And what we're doing, by the way, with the K3 theory is very significant and will be, have an impact in our world of, in what we call the clandestine arts, as well as tennis and the brain trauma rehabilitation and the theory of learning generally. So that's the background. That's how we got here. Now I spend most of my day, 80% of my day, doing research, and about 20% of my day, waking day, doing training kids using our K3 approach.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say that this radio show, it's sort of a sister to the Facebook site. It's grown over the years to quite a few coaches that participate in there. You've had your up, you know, you just like myself, you know, you've had your critics and the guys that follow you and whatnot. The critics would say to you, they'd say, well, the stuff you're doing is on people who have a debilitative condition. You're not really working with performance athletes. Can you answer your critics on that, in that sense, and explain how what the research you're doing, it pertains, and correct me if I'm wrong, to the mind in general? It doesn't necessarily pertain to one very segmented portion of the population.
Okay, well, let me address the performance issue. For example, one of the players who has gone through our program is the number one player in the state of Texas, a female. But the performance issue is addressed in the following fashion. We want objective measurements. So we track our players using the index computed by IMG, which they do for every sport, football, baseball, basketball, tennis. It's about the best objective measurement of progress that is available. It may not be perfect, but it seems to be the very best. And it's called the Relative Performance Index. And it's a way of measuring the performance of an individual against their peers, against all other people whom they have played. It's made up of three numbers. First number is the national ranking, which anybody can get. The second number is 50% of the national ranking of those who the individual has beaten. So essentially, by beating somebody with a higher national ranking, you kind of get benefit of some of their ranking going to your RPI, and then you look at 25% of the people you have beaten, whom they have beaten. So you collect together information that really tells you how you have functioned relative to other people. You know, a national ranking can be promoted simply by playing a lot of tournaments. You can just run points up. But see, the RPI neutralizes that, because if a person runs up a lot of points and you beat them, and you get the benefit of that, and that raises your RPI. So we use the RPI as a measurement of the success of the program, and therefore a measurement, objective measurement, scientific measurement of the nature of, or the implementation of the K3 theory. And in the paper that will be coming out, we actually show RPIs from two different students, and we pick these particular students. There are several cases we show. One's a brain trauma, tumor on a brain stem, as an example. Another one is a damaged leg, and so forth. But anyway, we use the RPI data, which is objective. It's something we can't tamper with. Anybody can go and look at it. It's available to anyone who wants to see it. And we look at how the person in our program progressed versus, by coincidence, we had two people leave our program because their parents felt they could do better, and we show how once they left our program, they flatlined. But in our program, we see show a steady increase in progress to a very high level, and then when the parent took the child out, the parents get greedy, I guess, child flatlined. And both cases, they flatlined. So now it is normal to see people flatline. It is not normal to see people have an RPI with a positive slope, a steady growth. So the examples we show are RPIs that we can document of players that we have taught and who show steady growth in our program. So the question is, well, what is that program and where does it come from? Well, the background is the work of Freeman at Berkeley and partially the work of Robert Cosma at the University of Memphis. And what Freeman did something extraordinary. He actually postulated a theory of brain dynamics. Never before has it been done. There's been a lot of talk about, well, the brain operates off neurons, but that doesn't really tell you anything. A theory has to have predictive power, the ability, if you implement it, to be able to predict outcomes, to be able to show development. So we implemented this and took 16 years to do it. It's not a trivial matter. And now we'll tell you what are the two or three key ideas, of which there are many, many aspects that we've implemented. But if you're going to understand the KQ theory in one single idea, it's this, that you develop components to a person's performing an action, not a whole template. It's very common when you see a person learn a serve, they'll take the racket back, they get the feet right, they go through the entire motion as a single unit. Now, it turns out the brain does not retain that information. It'll overnight try and break that down, so which means the next day you kind of have a restart. What the brain does do, what the KQ theory says it does, and which is what evolution has demonstrated, is it looks for the individual components of an activity that can be used in diverse ways. Now, many sports do this automatically. Gymnastics is a great example of a component-based learning process. Even football has implemented component-based thinking, and they didn't get it from Freeman. They got it from common sense. They just looked at it and said, hey, best to figure out if you can do a simple part of a stroke or an activity. You can't do that, you certainly can't do the whole activity. And by stringing it together and making it more complicated, you just simply make the problem harder. So if you're going to think of one thing about the KQ theory, it's component-based. And these are action components that are the smallest possible action that could be useful. The second aspect about the KQ theory is that it's based on intentionality. If you want to do something, you have to have an intent, a desire, a reason to do it. So the KQ theory says intentionality is primary. Without intentionality, nothing goes forward. And the third thing that you could recall that you can keep in mind is the speed with which intentionality and components can be developed. And the KQ theory does all of those things. So the component-based thing, we can contrast that with the template-based. Let's take the forehand, for example. The most important component or event in the forehand is the racket contacting the ball. There's nothing more important than that. That determines everything about where that ball is going to go. That has to be driven by your intentionality. So you see the two aspects of the KP theory are immediately just on display here. A component, which is the contact between the racket and the ball, and the intentionality to achieve a goal or a purpose in contacting the ball and having the racket hit the ball. So now the KP theory then says, don't get in the way of the player. You give them the first component, rely on their intentionality, and then you stand back to see what are they going to do with that. Now, we know from early childhood development that no child develops the ability to walk by being told how to walk. They experiment and they explore. So you hand the student a component and allow them to experiment and explore. Not only is this the most rapid way of learning, it empowers the individual. They begin to take ownership of the knowledge because they went through something personally to discover all the possibilities of the racket contacting the ball. Now, so far, I haven't said anything like I learned from Dick Gould. You take the racket back, step, turn, swing, check feet back, balance racket position. That's the way I learned from Dick, who is truly one of the great people and great mentor that I knew back in the 70s. However, the component-based approach, which is now 40 years hence, is a far superior approach. So now we might ask, well, what's the next component? Well, if contact is a component, how do we assure clean contact? And the only way to assure clean contact is to have the racket advance forward in a very straight, controlled manner until it has contacted the ball. And by the time it contacts the ball, by the time you understand or feel contact, the ball is long since gone. Now, in doing this, we've discarded a lot of traditional thinking, such as the so-called follow-through, where you check the racket over the person's shoulder. Well, that doesn't have intentionality associated with it. It has no components associated with it. It has no result associated with it. So we simply discarded that and said, okay, let's see. Do you really need that? If you do, it will reappear on its own. We found that the follow-through never came up. But the process of following through did come up automatically, but you didn't have to say anything about it. You didn't have to micromanage it. It's another important part of the component-based or the K3 theory is you cannot micromanage the student. We are minimalists. We say as little as possible instead of saying as much as possible. I had a friend of mine who I have great respect for worked 30 minutes with one of my students on the serve. In 30 minutes, he spent 25 minutes talking. So she hit balls for 5 minutes. Of course, the next day, there was absolutely nothing left of that lesson. So there was 30 minutes of totally wasted time. Whereas a person simply focused on the contact of the ball to the racket and hit many, many samples, another part of the K3, to develop components, you have to have many, many samples, essentially thousands of samples. That's the way the procedural part of the brain works. So, simply by getting that contact focused on, the other parts of the brain will start to fall into place for the most part. Occasionally, you have a wrinkle that you have to iron out through a process of intense repetition called radical behaviorism. But for the most part, a human being will fill in what comes before the contact, and what comes after, they just let that take care of itself. I think Joe Dinnifer had the greatest explanation of the follow-through of anyone I've said. He says, the reason you follow through is so you don't hurt yourself. That is, you don't try and stop the racket from moving because you can actually hurt yourself, so you just let the racket go. So those are three of the most important ideas, is components, intentionality, and experimentation. Allow the student latitude to experiment. As a result, the RPI that we show of our students in that book, in that paper, the chapter that will come out, shows an extremely rapid increase over even a 10-week period. You can see dramatic changes, improvements in a person's skill. And we've tracked another one over like eight months. And in both cases, the parents, for some reason, because parents always think they can do better, transfer these students to a conventional program, which turned out to be great for us, and they both flatlined immediately. And they flatlined over 4 months. There was absolutely no improvement in either player for September, October, November, December, January. Oh, 5 months. 5 months they showed no improvement. Whereas with us, in 10 weeks, we showed improvement in one and a steady positive slope improvement over 8 months in the other person. So we see that the hands-off approach, which is how the human being evolved, is how the brain evolved. And also in the chapter on the K3 theory, we ask the question, why did the brain evolve this way? We go into paleoanthropology. The paper is not an easy read, even though it's about tennis. It turns out that no one in the tennis community had much success in reading it, because it's a dull and laborious effort to try and read this paper. So anyway, the one part of the way the humans learn naturally is don't interfere excessively. We didn't have language, probably language developed maybe 100,000 years ago, probably developed in females before males. Certain things had to be in place in the esophagus, in the brain and so forth before you could even have language. So for the Homo species and its predecessors, they were learning using component-based learning without any instruction for at least 3 million years. That's a heck of a head start. And we kind of got carried away in this era getting into the habit of talking and instructing, when in fact we really don't need to do that. And people feel like you need to instruct for various reasons, partly because they want to feel involved, partly because they like to be in control, partly because they just don't think the student can figure out things for themselves. And those are all, of course, mistaken views. So another part of it was complexity versus simplicity. Now, this was a great idea. Recently, this feeds into something the USDA did in making tennis simple. They actually invented these low-compression balls, and they trained students to do something that's extremely simple, and they're more successful because it is simple. But the K3 theory tells you those people will not develop an advanced skill level because they don't develop advanced components. What we know about the development of the human brain is that it evolved in an environment of intense complexity, essentially of an environment of chaos. So, for example, the yellow ball is much more complex to deal with than the dead balls or the ROG balls. So consequently, by using the ROG balls, you actually run the risk of underdeveloping the child's brain. Now, we know we have an intense amount of research that shows that mental development in a child accelerates in the presence of a complex, rich environment. And the more simplistic you make that environment, the less development, neural development we see taking place. So complexity versus simplicity is a part of the Casey theory. Intentionality, that is, you want to do something. You've got a purpose in mind to do it. It operates on components.
Can I cut in here and ask a few questions?
Sure.
Let me ask you, now, you mentioned the second aspect of the K3 theory is intentionality, and you talked about that being the intention of hitting a forehand, either in, I suppose, being able to hit it to the other side of the court. That is not motivation, is that right? So intentionality is not what we would consider to be motivation?
Well, that's an interesting subtlety, JP. Motivation is a desire to do something. Intentionality is the actual act of doing it, carrying it out, doing what you desire to do. So motivation is a key thing. And evolution and the K3 theory rely very heavily upon motivation, and particularly motivation to survive was what drove the development of all animals. So, and that's a curious thing you bring up, because in today's world, by simplifying everything around us, not just tennis, but SAT scores, high school education, you reduce the importance of motivation. So you have a lot of students who are highly unmotivated, and so consequently their development is lessened by the lack of motivation. And, of course, now motivation comes in another factor. I mentioned earlier that you have to hit many, many balls. Procedural memory, which is what we're talking about, learning a skill, requires, it's not what we would call repetition. I'd call it better samples, because you can never repeat the same forehand twice. That's just not going to happen. There's always your physiology. The moment you swing the ball, your physiology changes. So you're never in the same state, mental, you're never in the physical same state. So what you must do to develop all the components is to have many, many samples. And that means thousands. We're not talking about a couple of hundred hitting 10 balls and then saying, okay, you're fine. I mean, we're talking about thousands. And we have worked out benchmarks on that. 4,000 is a key number. 10,000 is a key number. 50,000 is a key number. So you have to have many, many samples. Now, to do the samples, like we'll have a person come in our summer program, and the first thing they do when they step on the court is hit 1,000 balls every day. 1,000 balls. You do that in less than an hour. Now, they're motivated. It requires motivation to do that, and it requires discipline, the ability to persevere on, push forward in the play, in the presence of a challenge. And then it requires mental toughness as well.
Question, when you require them to come out on the court and hit 1,000 balls, are they having to hit those balls in the court in a certain way, or are they just hitting the ball?
All right, it's a two-stage process. Because intentionality is going to ultimately rule the player when they first start, and they're usually hitting on a ball machine, so they hit a ball once every 2 seconds. That's way above real time. You cannot expect that those balls are going to go in to start with. But what happens is, just like in nature and in the K3 theory, the fact that you are intending to hit that ball and you're trying over and over and over, the brain overnight will start to put things in place. You come back the next day and more of your balls are in. And come back the third day, even more in. So you start off where maybe you're 5% accurate. We don't worry about that. Don't even think about it, because you can't really, you get yourself into micromanagement. The brain simply doesn't work that way. You have to give it the overnight process of putting things together. So the first day, maybe 1%. The 15th day, after 15,000 balls, you may probably be around 70 or 80%. And what you'll find is intentionality rules, and you'll find yourself getting the ball in more and more and more because you want to get the ball in. But you start off in a pretty crazy way. Now, that brings up another point that you serendipitously, is how does advancement take place? And Chuck Creasy will second this as well. I can't make a player better if they don't push the envelope. If they push the envelope, the ball is not going to go in. It's going to go wild. That is your measurement. You push the player to the point that you have chaos. The brain is great at handling chaos. Overnight, it'll start putting that together for you. You come back the next day, that level that you pushed for, you'll find the balls are not as chaotic. They're not as random. They're much more disciplined, that you have, your body and mind have started to gain control at the level of that level of the envelope. And then that, after that stabilizes, then we push the envelope again. It's just the same way Chuck Yeager pushed the envelope on the sound barrier. You go up and you fight it out and you push yourself. So if you get carried away with forcing them to put every ball in, all you're doing is slowing them down. Brain doesn't work that way. K3 theory, it does say it doesn't work that way. Let them experiment, get lots and lots of balls. They will converge very rapidly. It'll be astounding. You will not believe how fast the player comes around to hitting with consistency. All the time they're hitting many balls, they're developing the physical neuromuscular infrastructure necessary to hit a ball and to control it. So a lot of things are taking place when you're hitting those 1,000 balls. Of course, we supplement that with a lot of other things. The other thing we found about the K3 theory, because we only test, our only measurement is RPI and performance in tournaments. RPI comes from tournament performance. It doesn't come from anything. It comes from sanctioned tournament performance. And so one of the things about the RPI is that since it's a measurement, we're only looking at how the person performs in a tournament. Well, there are obstacles to performing well. So in order to prove the K3 theory, we had to look at all the factors that could cause a person to fail or to not succeed as rapidly as or at the level we were expecting. The first and foremost is the mental state. If the player has got all kinds of mental confusions, I don't care how well you develop their stroke, they'll go out there and make a mess. If the player is physically unfit versus their opponent, they can go out and make a mess. So you really don't know what you've got. So the K3 theory, to implement it, we had to put into place the mental toughness training, physical toughness training, and the technique training, which comes down to the mesoscopic component part and the development of components all of this training comes together with intentionality, desire. We find, by the way, in our program, since I have the luxury to do this, if we don't have kids with intentionality and desire, we show them the door. Either they come there and perform at a high level, or they're out the door. And I have thrown an extraordinary number of perfectly gifted athletes out of our program because they didn't carry their load. Now, that's another part of the K3 theory tells you that if you create a group in which peer pressure becomes significant, intentionality is amplified. Each player wants to keep up with their peers. Now, if you have a group where people all agree to be non-performers, you got a problem. That happens in group sports like football and basketball, baseball. People can all agree to kind of slack off. In our program, if anyone slacks off, it shows up right away. That person's consistently slacking off, they're out the door. If the parent objects to their working this hard, they're out the door. We just don't bother with them because you cannot demonstrate a neurological theory with that kind of constraint. You cannot have a parental constraint. You cannot have a constraint where the person just isn't disciplined or motivated enough to go out and do the hard work to prove the theory. So our program had to add on. That's why it took so many years. We started off with technique. Many years we evolved a physical training program, and then we had to develop a significant mental training program. It took a long time to put all these things together. And now we have a program that's very efficient at moving people very quickly because there's no micromanagement. We have basically a hands-off approach. We focus on components that have a purpose, that have an intentionality associated with them. We take students who are interested in being champions and interested in being the best they can be, because if they're not motivated, you can't use them. You can't prove anything about a theory with people who don't want to do anything. So we throw them out.
All right, let me take a quick break. Doc, look, I've got 100 questions. I mean, I've written out, I've got my Post-it pad here. I got a lot of questions. I want to come right back. I got to pay this bill for this radio show, so let me take a commercial break here. And I've got callers online. Hopefully some guys want to listen in, have been listening in and want to ask questions. It's the We Coach Tennis radio show with Dr. Ray Brown. We'll be right back. We'll take a commercial break, and we'll talk to him in just a few minutes.
Hi, this is Coach Chuck Creasy. All of you know that I take pride in calling it the way it is. And boy, oh boy, is it an exciting time in tennis. The 10 and under stuff, the juniors, the pros, and college. If you want to hear the cutting edge of the real stuff and not just the diluted and watered down fluff, folks, listen to Coach J.P. Weber on the We Coach Tennis program every Tuesday at noon Eastern Standard Time. Here on the Yellow Ball Network.
I can't think of a better place to go than courtmakers.com for any of my court equipment needs. Any kind of equipment that you need for your club or facility. Windscreens, nets, net straps, benches, scoreboards. You can find all of this at courtmakers.com. Or like them on Facebook and see all the latest stuff that they're doing in court construction, resurfacing, and lighting. That's courtmakers.com, courtmakers.com.
Hey, come play the Marietta Grand Prix. It's a lot of fun. You get to play a lot of tennis, and we have Chick-fil-A sandwiches from Chick-fil-A. And you get to eat a lot. And if you can, you can play doubles with your friends or with your dad or your mom.
Hey, folks, this is J.P. Weber. Take it from the kid. The 2015 Handmade Charlotte Marietta Grand Prix Series of Tournaments is a great way to spend the day with the family playing tennis. To find out more, go to www.tennisdynamics.net. That's tennisdynamics.net, where you can call us at the Laurel Park Tennis Center at 770-919-8602.
Don't
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you.
All right, Doc, I'm back. Are you still on the line there with me?
I'm still here, buddy.
Okay, great. This live radio. Okay. All right, a couple of things that came up real fast, and I want to see. Every time I talk to you, it ends up going back to the dogs in my mind. And, I spent 10 years after coaching college tennis, I spent a lot of time training bird dogs. And I went up to this guy in Greenville, South Carolina, amazingly talented guy. And if you look at dog trainers around the world and you look at people, they want to get involved in it. They want to tell the dog to do this and tell the dog to do that and hold the position here and hold it. People love having control over their dogs. And I think I was lucky, seeing this, because it's animal behavior at a very basic level. But this guy, he was exactly the opposite. He had very, very successful and good-looking dogs, and it was the art of doing it, and his dogs were beautiful. But he got out of the way. He left bird dog training between the dog and the bird. That was the best way for the dog to learn. And I sort of got that from you when you were talking earlier. You were saying, let him hit the balls. Talk less. Get out of the way of the kid. Give him the ball and the racket, and let him hit. Am I off base? Is that right on target with what your message is there?
That's right on target, JP. Absolutely.
You know, it's amazing. The other thing that came up with me, you mentioned chaos, and you mentioned how in chaotic situations, children can perform. And if we challenge them with those chaotic situations, that's the best way for them to learn. And I think that's one of the components you said of the K3 theory. Now, early on when I was learning about how to coach and studying guys, I wanted to find out more about this guy Bobby Knight, and I read some of his stuff and listened to some of his videos. And while he may have questionable ways of approaching things, at least, in hindsight, people can look back and say, well, he probably shouldn't have yelled, thrown a chair, punched a player. I don't know, the different things that he did. As far as from a coaching standpoint, what he did was he made practice so demanding and so chaotic for the players. He would do one of his practices was, I think, a 5-on-2, 5 offensive players to 2 defensive players. And those two, he expected and demanded those 2 players to stop all 5 offensive players. Is that, again, a way in which this K3 theory is headed? Is that an enlightenment?
That's an excellent example. Now think back. You can go back to the paleoanthropology. Nature was always 5-1 or 5-2. That's just the way we evolved. So we have evolved to deal 5-2. I'm using the metaphor that five is just, and 2 are just numbers. It's just a metaphor. But that's exactly how we've evolved, to be able to cope with extreme demand. So in our program, we put kids under extreme pressure. But we don't put them under pressure in a careless and thoughtless way. It's not like we have a fanatical safety program, because our program is so demanding. We have to focus on safety. We have red flags that everybody who's an instructor knows how to watch for. If a student shows the slightest lack of confidence, we back off. If they show that the ATP process is breaking down, and that's a technical, physiological thing, we know to back off, et cetera. So we have a whole series of things you have to watch, because you cannot push a kid beyond their limits and expect them to grow. You push them up to the envelope, to the point where their performance seems erratic, but they eventually will begin to be able to cope with and control that erratic performance and turn it into something really useful. And yes, what Bobby Knight did, that's brilliant. 5-1-2, I love the idea.
All right, let me ask you, when you were talking about an RPI, and that is, I think you called it the Relative Performance Index. Now, you didn't call it that. This is something that came. It's computed weekly by IMG, and it's computed weekly by IMG for who? Who is it, and how is it computed again exactly? Because you mentioned, I think, you mentioned one component of it being the national ranking, and then you mentioned the second component being 60% of the national wins that you have, 60% of it being the wins that you have over kids that are ranked ahead of you nationally. I suppose the other 40% would be the losses that you have to kids ranked below you?
Okay, let me clarify this. IMG, International Management Group, computes relative performance index for every sport. Football, baseball, basketball, tennis, you name it. A sport that has a commercial value, IMG computes that for tennis. The relative performance index for men or boys is computed on Thursday of each week. For girls, it is computed on Friday. So if you've got a girl, you look on, you check, and roughly it's central time, it's around 3 or 4 o'clock, it'll appear. Now here's the three numbers. The first number is your national ranking. The second number is the national ranking of those you have beaten. That's 50% is who you have beaten. So the 25% is how well you've performed yourself. 50% is how well you have defeated people at their best. And 25% is how well those people you beat, who they beat. So it goes down one more layer there. So it's really three layers deep. And so they combine those three numbers, 25%, 50%, 25%, and come up with the relative performance index. That's why they call it relative, because you are being judged relative to your peers, to anybody else you have played. It doesn't matter if they're in your age group or not. You get judged by whoever you play.
How long a time period do you need to have it yield a legitimate RPI?
Well, it doesn't really take but a few weeks to do that because of the way it's computed. So it's done weekly, and if you go on tennisrecruiting.net, you can find it for any tennis player, what their RPI is. They track both national and RPI. Just a few weeks, you can start seeing a trend. Now, I published the other day on your website. Now, let's see, the radio program. This is the voice of We Coach Tennis. That's what you're doing right now. It's the voice of We Coach Tennis. But the other site, the website, I published a series of RPI examples to show what could happen. And I took it from real life, going on the web and looking at these what's out there. And I generalized or abstracted from what I actually see. And I published, I think, four different examples, so that you can see here's an RPI this is a good thing. Now here, and then there were three others that were RPIs that are red flags. Anytime an RPI flatlines and you're not at 98%, now if you're at the top of the heap, you expect the flatline because you there's nobody else to beat you, and that you don't really have other people you can beat. So your RPI will flatline up at a 98 percentile level, 98-99%. Well, that's fine. But if you're anything below that, like 95, you have room for improvement. So you can start seeing that within just a few weeks. You can actually see there's an upward trend, or is it a chaotic trend, or is it an actual downward trend? You'll see all these on those RPIs. I have examples of people who went along at 85%, at the 85 percentile, and then suddenly just took a nosedive down to 70. That's bad news. They don't bother to compute it below 50%, and possibly the reason for that is that 50% is a coin toss, or your result is the same as tossing a coin. You'll be right half the time. So anything 50, 55% and above are really the only numbers you need to look at, and most people you'll see flatline, and a very large quantity of them flat ran around 70%. And that tells you that person's got a lot of room for improvement. The RPI is the joint statement of the player and the coach if they're with the same coach over a long period of time. If it's, they're with them just a couple of weeks, you really can't tell as much. So that's what the RPI is. IMG does it. It's completely objective. You cannot control it. You cannot influence it. You cannot politicize it. You can't dilute it. You can't say, oh, my goodness, I came in second. Can't you make my RPI a little smaller, a little bit better? You can't do any of that. It's an objective number. It tells you what you have done in objective terms.
And this is calculated solely on a national level?
Yes, it's a national level. Anybody in the United States who plays football or plays tennis in any club, any high school or college, they are going to get an RPI by IMG. And since tennis is our subject and junior tennis is the main thing we look at, the RPIs for junior tennis are the things that a coach would look at and should look at. Because their national ranking could be way above their RPI, which means that they've been essentially collecting points by playing a lot of tournaments, but not winning very much. We know we can add our ranking, even in the professional level, simply by playing a lot of tournaments. You play 40 tournaments a year, you get a higher ranking than the person who played 20 simply because you accumulated more points. But a meaningful number. So the RPI is a meaningful number.
Were you so bold on the site as to say that had a player been with you and not been with someone else, they wouldn't have flatlined?
No. There's no way to know that. You can't.
What are the causes of flatlining of performance in your mind?
You have to understand it's a complicated issue. A student can flatline for many reasons, none of which have anything to do with the coach. Could be the parent. The parent is really, particularly the father, it could be the father of the flatline. The fathers are just remarkable at flatlining their own students, their own children. So you would have to make a long list of all the things that can flatline a student. If I were to make such a list, I would rank the parental support group as up at the top of that list. And you can't make an absolute list. There's no way to say what's absolutely number one cause. Number two cause, but you could say, well, here are the top five causes in some order, but we don't really know what the order is.
What would be top five? What would be top five, would you say? And when you say, let me start with this number one. When you say it's parental support, is that financial support or is that emotional or what type of support?
Moral support, not financial, but moral support. Because you can play a lot of tournaments in your own neighborhood. As a city like Houston, there's lots of tournaments you can play. You can play two tournaments a month. That's plenty. Doing more than that is you're probably going to flatline if you play more than two tournaments a month because you're not developing. You're just staying the same. So there's plenty of tournaments to play, and you should play in your own age group, not above your age group, because by playing above your age group, you're never really challenged. You feel like it's okay to lose because they're better. So, like Lansdorf pointed out, there's no mental challenge to playing above your age group. You got to beat your peers. They're the ones that scare you. The people you know well, you've played many times. They're the ones that can really create real fear in your head, and you've got to learn to beat them.
Once you've dominated your age group, though, you could then possibly begin to play up.
That's right. If you dominate the age group, then it's very reasonable to say, okay, but now you need to understand that it's a two- or three-step process. Once you step up an age group, you're moving up to guys and girls who are physically stronger than you. So now you're going to have to bring your physical strength up to match that. They have more experience. Because they're older, they may be 2 years more experienced than you have. So you've got to recognize, well, this player might be a smarter player, and I've got to learn how to play smarter ball. They may have a better skill at intimidating, and so you got to learn more about intimidation. So when you play up, after dominating or being competitive, you don't have to be the best in your age group, but you should be up there in the top four, five, or six to be playing up. then you understand what are the parameters or the factors that could affect me when I play up. And I just mentioned several of them, and, you know, the physical, the intimidation, the experience. You could run into a player who's just simply got a better coach, and you got to figure out, how come this player is playing better? How come they're making better decisions?
Now, are you finding that? Wait, hold on. Let me catch up with you. Are you saying that having a coach that's making the better decisions is a reason for flatlining?
No.
Okay.
I'm saying you'll make progress if your coach is able to help you understand the nature of this game, which is a rally, a conversation. It's not just arbitrary. It's a real conversation. You're gathering information about the opponent. The opponent's gathering. If you have a coach who can teach you to understand the nature of eye-to-eye combat, you have an advantage. If you go in there thinking, well, I want to hit the ball and move an opponent around and just sort of some crazy, arbitrary, disorganized thought process, well, don't be surprised if you lose. But if you learn how to use intimidation in your favor, how to discover your mental weaknesses of your opponent, what will cause them to morally collapse, now the coach who can teach you that, you're going to just be way ahead of the coaches who don't understand that.
What's another reason for flatlining in performance?
Kid doesn't want to be there. Doesn't really want to be there. Parents are making them be there. They don't want to be there. So this don't ever get better. Is that a surprise?
No, that's a good one. I was actually writing it down. What's another one? Give me your top five. You got parental. You got lack of motivation on the part of the child. What are two or three more?
There's cultural. There's a very big difference between cultures. And there are cultures in which a child is taught to be subservient to authority. A child who's taught to be subservient to authority, when put on the court and are put in eye-to-eye combat, and that authority, and there's nobody there to help them, that child can flounder, even though they may be athletically superior. I've seen several players like this who are athletically beautiful, superior, extraordinary people. But they came from a culture, and we're not going to mention that, which cultures are which. You've got to figure that out for yourself. But various cultures teach the player to be subservient to an older, superior person or just to authority in general. And that can translate into how you see your opponent. You can see your opponent as an authority, and they're next thing you know, you're losing. So first, I don't know about first, but let's say we've mentioned parents. We've mentioned motivation. You want to be there. We've mentioned culture. We've mentioned understanding the nature of the game. We've mentioned the coach and the coach's commitment. The milieu you work in, the environment, your coaching environment. If you're in an environment where you have a bunch of kids and they're all about the same, you can tend to stay about the same. So you all kind of flatline together. It becomes actually an agreement between you. I know when I was in high school football, I was a linebacker, and I always intended to knock the fool out of anybody. And one day, a guy, Nesbitt, he comes up to me, and he said, well, you know, you shouldn't be hitting so hard, you know, and you won't get hit so hard. I didn't understand that. I just hit people. But the same thing can happen in tennis. They can all collectively agree not to perform at their highest level, to kind of cruise. That can cause them all to flatline. So that list can really get going. Your physical conditioning, you know, that's a broad category. Girls, the relationship to their father. The father teaches you to be a fighter. There's no question about that. The father is responsible to teach the child to fight and defend themselves. Kids I have found whose father may have abandoned the family at an early age are floundering. They have to learn about how to be a fighter, so they can flatline very quickly. So that's what I'm thinking. That's what I can think of off the top of my head.
Those are good. Let me ask you. I want to. We'll try to conclude here. I want to ask you one more. I could stay on all night with you, but I've got to get moving, and I know you do too, and I know I've gone over the hour that I requested of you. You mentioned experience. How does that fit into this K3 theory of brain dynamics?
That's an important question. You have some people arguing, well, you have to have lots of matches. You need the experience of lots of matches. Well, actually, that's a red herring. That can be easily misunderstood. What's the point of playing a lot of matches? One of them is habituation. Get comfortable and used to being in the match environment. The new situation, the first time you play a tournament, people can freeze up. After they play several tournaments, they kind of get comfortable with it. Seeing a variety. Well, if you have a good training program, that variety should appear in your training program. So when you see a player who has a great slice, there should be no surprise. So playing a lot of tournaments to find out that other people have different styles shows that you have a coaching deficiency in your own program, because a good program teaches you the full spectrum of styles that you expect to face. Just the same way we do in the military. The first time you go into battle, you've got to be prepared for all that could happen. The same thing is true in a tennis training program. You've got to be prepared for everything, all the eventualities, all the things that can happen, and have sort of backup ideas about how I'm going to handle this. I kind of lost track of where we were going with this. But
experience and the way it relates to brain dynamics in the K3 theory in terms of what you guys are...
Right. So you have to learn the components of all the things you can do. You have to learn the way the other person thinks, and your own intentionality has got to motivate you to go out and want to beat the opponent. So experience, an enormous amount of the experience can take place right in the club itself or the academy, whatever your venue is, and based on the coach having the ability to create a broad, complex environment, like Bobby Knight did. He created a broad, complex environment. Okay, so the experience helps you conform or confirm that. And it's like a test. You study a chapter of math, and then you take a test. Well, you study for a week or a month of your tennis, and you go out and you take a test. So the experience of winning and discovering that what you learned in practice actually does work helps reinforce your confidence, and it helps your brain to hang on to and perfect and retain the components that were successful.
But I think I fall very quickly for that red herring of the matches, of playing lots of matches, because I look at the matches as being sort of part of that, that's the closest you can get to the kind of experience that you need, no?
Well, but what does the word lot mean? You know, one match a month is plenty. Playing matches, we have a venue in our program called the Easy Match, in which you're forced to play with a set of rules that causes you to constantly think. And so we found that you create the same level of pressure in that match, and you play it every day, that you would experience in a tournament. And so you can synthesize match play and tournament venue to a very great extent with just the skill of your program design. And then the tournament, if you go into a tournament and you make a bunch of new discoveries, you got to wonder, as a coach, have you done everything you can to prepare your students properly? They shouldn't walk into a tournament with a lot of surprises. And since there are
like
no surprises...
Like you mentioned earlier that no forehand, that the moment you hit a forehand, the next forehand is not the same. You physiologically, you said, have changed. You know, how can you possibly prepare a player for every contingency of every match?
Well, if you can make a list of contingencies. Now, that's where the KC theory really shines, is by component-based development and by the nature of intentionality, your ability to adapt take the pieces you've got and reorganize them to do something new is in place. And because you've also developed ownership of the knowledge through experimentation and exploration, you are now in a position to go out and adapt to new circumstances. That's essential. And the KC theory is a cornerstone of that kind of development.
Well, let's leave it at that this week. Let's hold it off there. I'd like to bring you back on more because I'd like to know more about this. I'd like to learn more about how the theory of brain dynamics and I guess it's the theory of brain dynamics and is it called the K3 theory? Is that what is it exactly called?
Well, that's in the scientific setting. If you go into the journals and go online, you'll see K3. K-I-I at K3 is three Roman numeral, one. That's the theory you'll see. We call it the easy academy or easy method simply because that's something that's easier for people to remember. It's an oxymoron, too, because it's anything but easy. So the paper that I have written explains, it's about 30 pages. It explains all of this stuff, but in pretty dry scientific terms about how we designed it and so forth. Our textbook, which is about 700 to 800 pages now, is an implementation of this, and we are developing lesson plans, which we have eventually that will be available for people who are interested.
What I'd like to do, if you would do it, I find it very interesting. I would like to somehow is get you back on. Suit you up in a flak jacket. Let's get anybody that we can off of We Coach Tennis that would want to maybe, you know, counter you on this and answer those. Try to answer the critics. Does that make sense?
And sure.
And I'd like you to come back on. I think we've laid out here what you're trying to put forth. What I'd like to do is then like try to get people to. I don't think that you would have a problem with it. You know, obviously, you know. But I'd like them to try and punch holes in this way of doing it. I don't, you know, I think that, you know, I know a guy who exemplified quite a bit of this. There was a guy in El Paso, Gene Stogner, and he was not a big match guy. He grew up with sports like basketball and football and things like that, and he believed in practice. So, you know, there is this idea, but, you know, I would say that you're going up against a giant tidal wave of people who would say it's ineffective and it's not as good as playing matches. So maybe
if that were true, it would be true of all sports, correct?
That's
how many
right.
times you play a football game a week? Once. How many games you play throughout the year? Maybe 12. Mixed martial arts, how many times do you step in the ring? Mixed martial arts, well, you really can't afford to step in there very many times because you get such a beating, your body has to have a good deal of recovery. Ronda Rousey has not had a match, a fight, in 1 year. She will be coming up in February, her first fight in a year. The Williams sisters, early on, played very few matches, and the WTA had to make a rule to force them to play more matches because they didn't really have to do it. And so the counterexamples to the match play concept are enormous. I mean, there's a huge number of counterexamples. Gymnastics. How many gymnastics matches do you have a week or even a month? So if you look at if it's true for one sport, it has to be true for all. And if it's not true for all, then that's your counterexample.
So it's interesting because, you know, business now doesn't lend itself to doing a practice the way in which you would have to do it in order to duplicate. I'm skeptical of a program being viable and being a big rigorous program and being able to do it where the practice has to be the type of rigors that you're talking about in order to be able to put into practice every day. It would be you know, the mothers are the ones that bring them a lot of times, so the mothers would be you wouldn't be kicking them out as much as they'd be pulling them out, you know, and running to the hills. Save us from Dr. Brown.
I don't depend on her income.
Yeah.
I don't depend on the general public. See, my business is not a money business. It's a scientific business. It's a performance business. So I'm free to kick them out, which I do. I have made a lot of enemies.
Let's do it again. I like that. We've laid it out. We haven't had any banter back and forth much. I've asked you some questions. I would like to get the debate going somehow, banter back and forth. And will you come back on?
I will. I think you should set some ground rules for debate. Ground rule one, you cannot degenerate into making personal comments about the individual. That doesn't win an argument.
Sure.
The second ground rule is saying it's my opinion, and you have no evidence for it. That's worthless. You make no contribution. And the third ground rule, agree to disagree, means you lost. That's what the person who says
exactly.
You'll have to agree to disagree, they lost. That's what it means.
Exactly.
And so those are the only ground rules that I would say will keep it focused so that it actually produces something useful.
Well, Doc, I appreciate you having you on. It's been perfect. This was excellent. We got this out there. I think people will be able to download it and listen to it. And let's bring you back and let's go over this and see if we can't vet it out a little bit on a subsequent show. Does that sound good?
Sounds good to me, buddy. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Well, thank you, and I look forward to seeing you or talking to you again. Bye.
This has been the We Coach Tennis Radio Show on the Yellow Ball Network. Check in here with us every Tuesday at noon and listen to another great coach talk about what makes their program a success.